show.
Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Oh. Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane. And it's so good to be back with you guys for another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Nick John. Nick is originally from Canada, where he performed 4 main stage revues for the Second City in Toronto. Since moving to Chicago, he has taught at the Second City Training Center. He's taught at the DePaul Theater School. He's performed and trained at the I.O. Chicago. He is easily one of Chicago's most respected improv teachers, and he currently teaches improv to people who are on the spectrum. We talked to Nick about why that brings him so much joy, the difference between Canadian and American improvising, and how he approaches characters. Nick has a really great system about how he approaches characters, which I'm always fascinated with. Before we get to the interview with Nick, I just want to say, and I'm saying this as a proud father, Betsy, my daughter, who is now 15 months old, can you believe that, said her first complete sentence the other day when she was sitting in her high chair right after dinner. And she said, "Are you ready for this? I'm building a lot of suspense for it. I love you." She said that at 15 months. And Lauren was right there to back me up because I said, "Lauren, did you hear what she just said?" And she said, "Yeah, I think she said, I love you." And the reason I feel so proud about this is because I must say, I love you to Betsy 15, 20 times a day. Betsy, I love you. Betsy, I love you. And it's definitely something I didn't get when I was growing up. So it's so nice because when she said that, because it's like, oh my God, she heard me. She heard me. And I really feel like I'm a dad now. I'm a dad because she said a complete sentence. Now, of course, we asked her since then to repeat it, and she didn't, just like she does with the animal sounds. For some reason, she won't repeat the animal sounds in front of me. She won't do a cow moo or a horse neigh. She won't do those, but that's the kind of stuff you have to deal with when you have a 15-month-old child. Enough about me. You're going to love this interview. Here it is, the Nick John interview. Enjoy. Nick John, thank you for being our guest on Improv.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you grew up in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Both your parents were German immigrants. I married into a German family. My wife, Lauren, is German, so that we mean her parents are German. And this is being totally stereotypical, but this is what I've experienced from them. A bit rigid, no sense of humor, typical rule followers. How did you come out of that family interested in comedy?
Well, my dad was hysterical, actually, at home. In the workplace, which I have witnessed a couple of times because I worked at his company.
What did he do?
He was an accountant.
Okay.
But he worked for a pharmaceutical mm-hmm. company, so I would get a job working in the warehouse, and I would see him at work, and he was totally like just a straight arrow, very, very. So it was almost like he had a split personality, the home personality and the work personality. And my mom was a little rigid, too, but she was also very emotional. So I think I got my comedy chops from my dad, at least just acting silly around the dinner table.
In college, third year of college, you're studying to be a microbiologist.
Yeah.
And your parents want you to become a doctor. And then you take this free theater sports, which is an improv workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened to you after you took that workshop?
Oh, it ruined my life. It totally ruined my life. After the third class, I was hooked. It was something I really liked. I mean, I didn't mind doing the sciences, and I didn't mind that, but I knew that was what my parents wanted me to do. And I was away at school at that point, and I think I was having all my teenage rebellion in my mid-20s. So it was like, you know what, I really wanted to do theater and I really wanted to explore it. And it was something, even after the third class, in my heart I knew. It was like, this is fun and I'm actually pretty good at it.
Was there a moment where you, in those first three classes where you're like, an exercise or a scene where you're like, you know what, this is what I want to do.
Yeah, I think it was a yes and, like a really simple yes and or a gift-giving thing. There wasn't anything remotely scenic about it. The great thing about theater sports, too, was that it was really accessible. Like after the third class, somebody said, oh, you should come to the show and we'll have you be part of the door. Like it was very...
Work the door.
Work the door, yeah. It was very community-oriented. And it was like I stayed after one of the shows and said, hi, can I help? And they... You know, sort of let me in the community, and I didn't look back. And I was really lucky, too, because at the same time that I was doing that was around the same time that the kids in the hall were starting to hook up with each other. Three of the original guys were in Toronto, and the Calgary guys were in Calgary, and they were talking to each other. And I was friends with the Toronto guys, and... it was a really exciting time to do that.
And it, you mentioned the kids in the hall. Your first teachers were Mark McKinney and Bruce McCollum from Kids in the Hall.
Yeah, my first real, like, when I discovered theater sports for, like, midsummer, and then I went back to school.
And theater sports is more short form, right?
It's absolutely. It's all short form.
And it's John Stone-based short form.
Yeah, it's what comedy sports is here. I think they got the...
You're not going to get in any trouble saying that, are you?
No, I don't think
there's,
so.
There's no, like, no territory of, like, comedy sports is different than theater sports?
I don't think so. I don't know, but I do think that there was just a licensing thing, and I think... theater sports or comedy sports bought it from Keith for like a buck or something like that, or it was a handshake agreement. I don't think there's any ill will about it.
And you'd be honest, even though you're Canadian, and Canadians do not like comedy.
We never lie.
Right, okay. You never lie, but you're always very nice.
Yeah, unless we're playing hockey.
So you were telling me about Mark McKinney and Bruce McCollum really setting you straight.
Yeah, they were wonderful. And Scott Thompson was actually a classmate of mine. So it was a very, really exciting time.
Was Mike Myers floating around in that orbit then?
Mike was hooked into the whole Second City thing. And I don't think I took a Second City class until like the following summer. And by which point he was on main stage and away. I think at that point he was either touring company or doing that. But I don't think he ever really did theater sports.
Now, you said Bruce McCullough and Mark McKinney, they set you straight. What did they teach you at that point in your career?
Mark's really good at... was really good. I don't know if he teaches anymore. I don't think he does. But he was really good at the whole acting aspect of improv, which is really wonderful. And we had these very small classes, maybe five people. They were earning extra bucks, you know.
This is back in the 90s, right?
No, back in the 80s.
Okay, so it's a very small scene in Toronto at that time.
Yeah, and they had just moved into town. Kind of merged with the original. They were called The Audience in Calgary.
Well, the Kids in the Hall were?
Well, half of them.
Okay.
The Calgary half were called The Audience. They were given a weekly show by Keith at...
Keith Johnstone
at the Loose Moose Theater. And they just would write a show every week fresh and do just crazy stuff. And meanwhile, at the same time... Dave Foley, Kevin McDonald, and a really great writer, Luch Casmieri, were the kids in the hall in Toronto, and they'd heard about each other. So when the audience or members of the audience moved to Toronto, they hooked up and kind of merged, and everything sort of fell into place for that. Of course, that all happened while I was away at school, so I come... Go away to school and then come back, and it's like there's this fully formed unit with a weekly show that they did at the Rivoli.
And what was that like going to see their show? Was that it?
It was so exciting. It was really inspiring to see guys get up there and every week produce real material, like new material every week, and to produce really funny stuff, and sometimes their stuff was just really out and out just stupid and stupid funny. And sometimes it was really, really, really smart. And it was so great to see a classmate of mine, Scott Thompson, just find his own voice and do all the wonderful stuff that he's become known for. They really were, like, formative for me.
Was that a goal of yours to get into Kids in the Hall, or was that like you couldn't, nobody could get into it?
No, my goal was just to, was always Second City.
How did you come up with that goal?
Well, there was a point where, and this is a crazy story, there was a point where I was doing some stand-up, and I had become friends with these two guys, two stand-ups, and as you do when you're young, we went out for burgers after a show and got all like, oh, what do you want to do? What are we going to do? What are you going to do? And one fellow said, I'm going to be in L.A. doing stand-up in L.A. And the other fellow said, I want to be in New York doing stand-up in New York. And I said, I want to do Second City. Because that's where, even though I was doing stand-up, that's where I felt the most at home. By that time, I was taking classes. And, you know, as a teen, I saw a couple of their shows and was like, oh, that's what I want to do, you know, that where that's really fun. And then as a young adult in university, I would see, go see their shows, go see the sets, and it's like, this is it. And, of course, there was SCTV. It was, like, a really big deal in Toronto. So we all wrote down on a napkin a contract. In 5 years, I'm going to do stand up in L.A. In 5 years, I'm going to do stand up in New York. And I wrote 5 years, Second City.
But it happened faster for you, didn't it?
It happened a little faster than me, for me. It happened, took me about 3-4 years after that. So not much faster, you know.
And then you go from the touring company, and then 6 months later, you're in a main stage company.
Yeah.
And you end up doing some award-winning reviews up there,
yep,
in Toronto. When you look back on it, do you on what is your fondest memory of Second City in Toronto? Is there a scene? Is there a before the show, after the show? Some, you know, an alumni comes and plays with you. Is there a memory that sticks out for you?
It's really hard to pick one memory because I loved our company. We were like, we got really close as friends, off stage, huge amounts of respect. We all worked differently and we all like drove each other nuts like any cast would because you're working in a small shoebox and seeing each other all the time. There's a couple of scenes that I liked that had elements in it that I really loved. And there were a couple of scenes that, you know, we did that was like, after even a month of it, you're like, oh, I wish we hadn't have done that. It's a really tired scene and we couldn't figure a way out of it to write it. I really enjoyed working with, we had three really strong women in our cast, Kathy Greenwood, Judith Scott, and Jenny Parsons.
Now, Judith Scott, if I'm mistaken, she came down to Chicago then, right?
No, she came from Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure the whole story. I mean, it's so long ago. Not sure the whole story, but she was in Canada, and I think they were looking for somebody. She was in Canada at the time. They were looking for uh-huh. somebody, so they hired her, and she did all the reviews with us. Just a wonderful actor. Really, really, really great. Like wonderful to play with and to work with, you know. And I really, there was some kind of really fun chemistry that I had with Jenny Parsons that I've never been able to recreate. There was a really nice sense of just wonderful collaboration whenever we worked, and we were both like slightly bonkers. And Kathy Greenwood is like a genius. She's on, you know, she's on Whose Line Is It Anyways? And, you know, plays with Ryan and
Ryan those guys.
Yeah. Ryan Stiles and Colin Mochrie. And she's also does a wonderful review up in Canada called Women Fully Clothed with a couple of veteran actors, you know, veteran Second City actors.
So you went from touring company, and then 6 months later they put you in main stage.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you look back and say to yourself, because that's really fast. I mean, that is really fast.
Oh, my gosh.
Do you look back and say to yourself, I would have done this differently and that differently?
Yes and no. I was really lucky. They had a London company at the time.
London, which was a suburb of?
Suburb of Toronto, like a far suburb. It's about 2 hours away, which is a great place to learn how to put up a show because none of the producers from Toronto would be there all the time.
So you don't have the same pressures.
Yeah. When I moved right up to Toronto main stage, I was, you know, as you can imagine, I was just freaked. Funny story of it was I was doing a touring company show in Ottawa, and our stage manager got the call to drive me back because I was going to be seen that night. And they were
drive
all,
you back to Toronto. To Toronto main stage.
Yeah, and it's normally like we were going to stay overnight, or you know, and or there wasn't quite the hurry.
And when you mean seen, you were going to. They wanted to see you.
They wanted to see me perform. It was an audition.
But in front of the audience.
In front of an audience. So right. I was going to do the improv set. I had no idea that it was an audition, and it came out later that my stage manager, who I loved dearly, told the entire cast, do not tell Nick that it's an audition because he will freak out. So we drove back, and I was like, ba-da-ba-da. Meanwhile, the rest of the cast apparently were all just like on pins and needles for me. And I had a good audition.
So you get in, you do a couple reviews.
Yep.
And then what happens?
And then nothing.
What do you mean nothing?
Then I'm done. Like after four reviews, they said, you know, I think you should move on, Nick. And I agreed with them because I was tired. And I went back to doing theater sports, a little bit of stand-up. There was about 2 years of like me figuring stuff out. There wasn't as much of a scene, you know, in Toronto. There was like either Second City or stand-up, and that was it at the time.
But you end up doing film and TV parts.
Little bits, yeah.
And then you come to Chicago, following your wife.
Yep.
And here's this guy who's got all, you know, he's done four shows in Toronto, main stage, Second City. He decides to take classes at the IO Chicago.
Yeah. Because I realized that there's a huge difference in improv cultures.
What are the difference?
Well, we didn't have, at the time that I was in Toronto, we didn't have as much of a tradition of long form as you do here. Our stuff was either short form or very scenic, like Second City. There was, I think, Del came in like a couple of times, you know, to teach like guest workshops, which I always managed not to be able to make. And I know that Sheldon Patinkin came in, you know, and taught. I know Michael Gelman came up. But really, we didn't have. We had our own tradition, which was all very either pure Second City and real old school stuff, or theater sports, which was all Keith Johnstone, short form, but also very narratively driven as opposed to relationship driven. So I wanted to, when I came here, I was lucky enough to be able to take classes. I wanted to immerse myself in the Chicago scene and just be a student again because you don't get that opportunity that often. And I didn't know anybody. I wouldn't be taking classes with peers or with students. I'd be taking classes with people who were just taking classes.
You'd be anonymous.
It was really refreshing.
And why was it refreshing?
Because by the time I finished at Second City in Toronto, and I took some classes. I would take classes with students of mine as well. Like if I were going to take like an acting class or a stage reading class or a clown workshop, there would be students in class with me, which was always, I was able to get around it, but it was always a little off-putting. You know, it was like, do as I say, not as I do, that kind of thing. Whereas here it was like, oh, I don't know anybody and I can fail as badly as I want to and not worry about being judged.
And when you started, you got on a team at IO,
mm-hmm.
and I would imagine you're much older than most of these people. They're 24 years, 22. A lot of them are coming right out of college. You're laughing. What's so funny?
Well, they were so hungry. And every once in a while, somebody would ask me, don't you want to get into Second City? Don't you want to do Second City Chicago? And I was like, no, I've done it. That was my school. I got my postdoctorate. You know, now I'm taking Spanish. You know, I'm taking long form. I'm taking a different thing.
Did you ever tell them, hey, I did it? Or did you want to keep that secret?
I kept it secret until I got asked. You know, and so if somebody should find out, then I would tell them. Mm-hmm. And I think word got around after about 2-3 classes that I'd done it. But it was, after that, it was okay. It was just filled with, really hungry kids, and it was kind of fun to watch.
And how did your styles mesh with their styles? How did you adapt your Canadian style with now this new new American long-form style that you're learning?
There wasn't much to adapt because, at the end of the day, improv is improv, right? It's listening. It's saying yes and. It's being honest emotionally, depending on the scene. The only difference for me was this real emphasis on form, and that kind of boggled my mind. Because for me, the really important stuff is the scene. You know, everything else, after a while, seemed to be just noise. You know, what's a run? What's an opening? What's a game? It's like, well, I don't really care about that. I do care about being in a scene with somebody or a couple of other people and connecting and building that scene together.
As a teacher, what do you care about? If I'm in a Nick John class, what am I going to get?
You're going to get how to play. How to play characters honestly without doing a cartoon or a stereotype.
That's something that I've always struggled with. How do you play characters honestly? What's your theory?
I'm a big fan of playing everything you do to the top of your intelligence.
Okay, so what does that mean?
That means that if you have a character that may not be the smartest person in the room, he's still going to be smart in his own way and in his own world. You know, I may be hopelessly dense as a character, but at the same time, I know a red light means to stop in traffic. I know if I put my hand in water, in hot boiling water, it's going to burn me.
But you may not know what the Second Amendment is.
Exactly. You know, I might play like a doofus just for the sake of like being a doofus. But inside this split personality, the improviser part that's not the character part, he knows all about this doofus's world. You know, you make all these really quick Rolodex type decisions like, okay, this guy might, you know, he's a doofus and he's really like, dense, but at the same time, he probably knows everything there is to know about comic books or a sports team or one particular food he likes. And I think if you operate with that and if you operate with like a really good sense of heart space, like a really good sense of I love the people I'm with, even the performers, then you can't go wrong.
Now, I've gotten to work with you in a show called Every Old Man, which was great, directed by Liz Allen and also Scott Levy. So it was the three of us. And what you did, and I've seen it with you, John Hildreth does it, Michael Patrick Thornton does it, is you get a character immediately.
Yeah.
Tell me how you do that.
I can tell you where it comes from first. I hated, and I was never good at improvising when I was improvising a character close to myself. I was always, like, it always put me in my head. So I have to, for me to be comfortable on stage, really comfortable, I have to change something physically with me, whether it's the way I carry myself, something in my spine, an energy, even an accent. As soon as I do that, something inside clicks, and then I have, like, a want.
So let's just walk through this. As you were telling me this, you were kind of doing something with your shoulders.
Yeah.
You were kind of hunching your shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
So what would come out of that for you?
Somebody who may be a little low status, okay. a little nebbish.
Okay.
Immediately when I'm hunching my shoulders, my fingers start to, you know, play with each other. So all of a sudden I'm... No, not making eye contact or fighting for eye contact with you. And all of a sudden, my voice changes a little bit.
So give me a little of that voice. We can go into...
You know, just like a little bit like this. You know, and all of a sudden, I'm pushing my glasses up. And, you know, I'm a little stuttery. And I'm starting to talk like this. And, you know, I could see myself working in a computer lab. You know, and maybe being very smart with computers, but not so smart asking somebody out on a date.
Does the guy have a name?
Probably Stephen Jones.
Stephen?
Yeah.
We're all going to go to lunch with Kathy. She asked about you.
Uh-huh. Sure. I'll come out with you guys.
We're going to go to Chili's.
Chili's?
It's her birthday.
I wish I'd known. I would have. Oh, do you have a card? Everybody's card.
Yeah.
Can I sign that?
It's in my cubicle.
Okay. I gotta finish up here. I'll go back to the.
Kathy's really interested in you. She was bothering me. She's like, "Hey, Stan, is he going?" I said, "I'll find out." So
really,
yeah.
Oh, I think I might have to go to the bathroom before I go. I forgot. I was in such a rush. I didn't brush my teeth. I really hope this is gonna be. This is going to be just awful. Oh, my gosh.
So you're in?
Yeah. Sure. Okay. If I come late, just start without me. I got to finish
it's
this.
It's a surprise.
I won't say
anything.
I
mean, she asked about it, but you're the surprise.
I'm the surprise?
Yeah. Because I'm going to go back and tell her you're not going to lunch.
That's crazy. Thanks. That's really nice of you. I'm going to... Okay, I guess this can wait till after lunch. Normally I like to get the flow down, but okay, I'll get ready. I got my coat, and maybe I'll stop by a Walgreens and brush my teeth or something like that.
But don't forget to come by my cubicle before and sign the card.
I need to sign that card. Yeah. I'll sign the card.
Don't follow me. Don't follow me, okay? Because she's, you know.
Okay, why don't I wait?
Wait.
10 minutes?
Yeah, well, you were just going to put 10 minutes on your calculator watch there.
Yeah.
It's got a timer, right?
Right. I'm going to wait 10 minutes on this watch.
I'm going to go back to my cube now.
Okay.
Okay, so where was the want for this guy? Did it come up?
I think it did. I might be wrong, because it's sometimes so organic you can't put your finger on it. I think his want was really simply to be liked.
Okay, and how did that? Because when I work with wants, it usually doesn't happen automatically. It's something you kind of find.
Yeah, I kind of found that. I mean, I found that as soon as our relationship with the card sort of played out, and then like, oh, Kathy's coming to lunch, and then as soon as I discovered you did all this really nice stuff for this guy, I was like. Oh, okay. I mean, I just want to be liked. I don't want to rock the boat. And then I You know, that thing of like, I got to get this done, too. It was really important to him. So I have a feeling this guy's really like in a box, in a cubicle, and he's probably going to make a hash of the lunch, but you never know.
What other wants? Because I think wants are something that are really interesting to play. I don't know if a lot of people are teaching that still. I'm not sure. What are really fun wants that people can play that you've liked to play in the past?
I always pick two. I always pick, I want you to love me, or I want to be loved by you. And, you know, it's one of those things that's sort of like, it'll keep a scene positive. You don't end up arguing in a scene. And you could either pick it, you know, very high status, and you get this sort of like really big, rich character.
Or what would that guy sound like? You were puffing out your chest, sitting up straight.
Yeah, he's probably, I don't know, you know, probably one of these bros, probably one of these guys, you know. It's like, hey. And he might be wanting, you know, he might be wanting to be loved, but choosing completely the wrong way to do it. And it might all be bluster. I find when I'm in a scene and I'm like a little lost, maybe picking that up.
So those are your go-to. I want to be loved.
Yeah. Or I want to be loved.
Or if you want to be loved.
Yeah.
I understand I want to be loved. The first one, I'm not so sure about.
Yeah,
because the example we just did with the guy in the cubicle,
yeah,
he wanted to be loved.
He wanted to be loved.
Right.
Right. Sometimes it's really nice to play a pickup scene, mm-hmm. you know, and I know it's almost archetypal, but it's like, okay, I'm on scene with, and not in a creepy way,
right.
you know, but I'm on scene with somebody, and it's like, how do we really connect? Like,
right.
how do we really, really enjoy each other's company?
Mm-hmm.
And it might be, there might be a conflict, there might be a problem in there, but it's like, well, how do we, you know, like each other? How do I say this without sounding like a creepazoid? Because I'm not.
That's okay. I'm a total creep. And some, yes.
Yeah.
I love creep.
Some of the best scenes I've done have been like, I play, like, it's not seduction, but it's like, oh, I want to date this person.
Right.
I want to ask this person out. Or, you know, I want to. And seduce is too strong a word, but I want to connect with them
mm-hmm.
in a way that might be romantic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I never play that as an end game, you know, but I was like, oh, you know, what do you think? You think we should go out after work? Like
right.
that kind of thing as a go-to.
Mm-hmm.
Those are like easy. The easiest for me.
Now, also, you teach with kids on the spectrum,
mm-hmm.
autism. And I saw you, how long have you been doing this?
It's been 4 years now.
So I saw you maybe 3 years ago, and
mm-hmm.
you're like, I love this. This is the best thing and to teach kids on the spectrum, improv.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that you love so much about doing it?
Well, one, it's a challenge for me because I don't have any training in it. So all the it sounds awful, but like all the learning I've been doing mm-hmm. on my feet. I'm really lucky to have a really good teaching partner who has extensive background in special education. And so she's taught me a lot. But what's fun about it is that these guys, and they're adults too, these guys are honest, you know.
There's no filter.
There's no filter, and there's no there's really no agenda. You know, nobody is bucking for main stage
or getting a boat.
Not that they happen anymore.
Right.
You know, they're interested in coming to class and learning to improvise. We decided really early on not to make...
Because you teach it here at Second City Training Center in Chicago.
Yeah. And we decided really early on not to make this therapeutic at all. There's enough. And so what we're providing is just a break for these guys, just an improv break. And anything that, any of the benefits, any of the, in quotation marks, therapeutic benefits that they get, all happens through osmosis, all happens during the breaks. You know, so
what do you mean during the breaks?
Well, we schedule like a break time. It's a 90-minute class, and we'll have like a break halfway through, like a 10-minute break. And in that break, you see people who have a hard time connecting, beginning to connect with each other over a couple of weeks. It's nothing miraculous. It's nothing special. But it's like, oh, these guys are now talking about common interests where they weren't talking before. This fellow who's like really anxious is like relax and listening and joking. So it's a way of providing like this social mechanism, a social net for them.
So when I think of kids on the spectrum, some of them are they're more severe than others,
mm-hmm.
and some are missing picking up social cues.
Yeah.
How does improv help with that? Because so much is part of picking up social cues.
Isn't it? It's amazing. They pick it up. They pick up social cues left, right, and center. And some people are like, you know, they have their things, you know. And the other people will learn to work with them. We do a lot of matching. So it's like, get up on stage. Pick an activity. All right. Go up and join him. Do the same activity.
So someone's like painting the wall. Somebody else just paint the wall.
Paint the wall. 1, 2, 3 lines and we're out. And it's really challenging for them. So we go much slower than a normal A3 class. But like we have a mixed group called the Aspertypicals that have done a couple of shows. So mix are neurotypical and a couple of adults on the spectrum. And we do short form, and it's beyond funny and very charming. And these guys get it.
How'd you get interested in doing it?
So my daughter has autism, mm-hmm. and she's very young. She's 10 years old now. And early on, I started thinking, well, what is she going to be able to do with her life creatively? She's musically very gifted, so we're working in that vein. Concurrently with that, I was doing improv for anxiety classes here at Second City.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized after 3-4 classes, a lot of the people who have anxiety share that same issue with people with autism. Like, anxiety is a very big component, especially when you have sensory issues and social cue issues. So a lot of it is like, how do we deal with your anxiety? How do we get you in the room and comfortable when it's a really unnatural thing for you to do? And it's the same thing. So I pitched them on this, and they ran with it and were very, very generous with me as far as support.
You also, we talked about this. I wanted to bring this up because on Facebook, I think it was about a year ago,
mm-hmm.
you were very, very passionate about people using the R word, retard or retarded. And I just wanted to get, even in a comedy context, mm-hmm. what is your feeling about it? Because you were very articulate.
I think it's lazy. I think it's when it's used improperly, it's really lazy, especially in the vein of stand-up comedy and in some improv circles when it's dropped as like an R-bomb,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's so retarded.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for me it's the same kind of word as the N-word or calling somebody a fag.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same kind of pejorative.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people with mental delays have full-on lives and are very bright in other aspects.
Mm-hmm.
So I always find that really, really, really lazy. Now, do you stop using that word? Because some characters would you naturally use that word, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think so, but, you know, I'm big into not censoring. But, again, playing a character to the top of their intelligence. If you're going to use the word that you are, you know, if you're going to say that person is retarded, then you better have a legitimate reason to be talking that way. You know, either your character is himself or herself very ignorant. You know, you have to be cognizant of it. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, if it's just gratuitous, it's, you know, it's usually done for a laugh. And it's
so what I'm hearing is if it's coming from the character in a very selective way, it's okay.
Yeah.
If it's coming just you're saying it because you might be think you're going to get a laugh,
yeah,
then
try not to.
And has it come up in class when you're teaching?
Never. I have not encountered that at all.
And in that Facebook exchange, I noticed there was a lot of people from the improv community and stuff like that. Was there anything that surprised you? It's not about naming names, but people's opinion about that?
You know, I don't remember. I don't remember. I don't think there was anybody that shocked me. And, you know, it's not the kind of thing, like, if I hear somebody, you know, that I respect drop that word in conversation, I'll probably roll my eyes. But if it happens during a scene, I don't think I'll address it afterwards. You know, it's one of those things that I like, that's my fight.
Mm-hmm. You said something before we were talking, and I mentioned that I have a daughter, 15-month-old, cute Betsy Jane Corrine. How has, for you, being a father,
mm-hmm,
changed how you approach improv?
Well, and not only being a father, but being a father of someone with special needs. It's one of the reasons why I don't perform as nearly as much as I used to. There was a long period where it was like, you know, there was a lot of medical stuff happening that I had no time for anything else. And then once that got straightened out, it was like, well, I still want to be around and hanging out. She inspires me. Both her and my wife inspire me to do almost everything. The teaching improv for the autism spectrum came from her. You know, it was her inspiration to me. And watching her tackle the world is really interesting for me with regards to, like, how I teach. And to a certain degree, how I perform. You know, I realize that life is finite. So when I do play now, it's really with a sense of fun. In a sense of, like, I got nothing to lose here other than just, like, I want to play and have as much fun and connect as much as I can with my fellow performers.
We've got to wrap this up. And we ask the same question to our guests at the end of the podcast, which is, what piece of advice would you give somebody starting out in improv today?
Work on listening. I don't think that people listen enough to each other. It's one of the things that I see a lot of my students sort of fall down when I first, like, if I teach a level A, is what's involved in listening. Even if you don't have the yes and part down, you know, even if you're like a negative Nelly, if all you can do is truly listen to your friends on stage or yourself, then everything else should, like, just follow.
So people that are listening to this podcast are probably saying to themselves, if they're really listening, they're probably saying to themselves, well, what can I do? Because I hear this all the time. Or they get the same note. You need to listen more. Mm-hmm. You need to listen better. What's something that they could do that you teach that could help them listen even better?
Observe people. I know this sounds a little creepy, but when you're with somebody, friends, you know, watch them. Look at their body language. Listen not just with your ears and what they're saying, but what are their arms doing? If you're traveling on the L or on your transit, you know, look at the people around you. Look at people having a conversation. What are they saying? You know, can you hear what their words are? Are they running counter to what their body is doing? And the other thing that I always recommend is find moments of silence. Find a place to, like, walk around where there's no noise, you know, or little noise. Find a path, you know, in a park. Turn off the earbuds and just hang out for a bit. That sometimes can really help. And also when you're doing a scene, just slow down. You don't have to, not every scene has to be quick. Slow down and take that moment of like, okay, what is he or she really saying to me?
Because I've noticed with students is, it's not just verbal. It's not what they're saying verbally, but the tone. And a lot of people have a hard time picking that up.
Yeah. So, again, it's, and it, again, you know what? If it's an issue, match it. There's nothing wrong with, like, if you're throwing a tone at me, like, this is wonderful.
This is wonderful.
Exactly. And all of a sudden, we are now listening to each other in a different way.
Or if I said, this is wonderful.
Yeah, this is wonderful.
Yeah, it's really wonderful,
oh,
Nick.
It's terrific.
Yeah, it's great.
Absolutely terrific.
Great.
Terrific. It's so wonderful.
Yeah.
I want to walk out of here.
Yeah, so do I. Okay?
Exactly. So matching can really help.
So matching, you're acknowledging, really, listening.
Yeah.
And that's really very simple to do. And it's saying to yourself, you know what? I'm going to go with their idea.
Yeah.
And it's not cheating, because I think a lot of people think it's cheating.
Yeah, I don't think it's cheating at all. I don't call them, when I teach, I call them pro tips. You know, here's a pro tip. Always, when in doubt, match.
Any other pro tips you can share with us? We love pro tips.
Always touch an object in the room. First thing.
Do you come in with an object? Or you're saying if you're like, floundering, grab an object.
Grab an object.
Okay.
You know, open a door. Mm-hmm. Open the window.
Why is that important?
Because it gives you a place to go to when you get lost, other than your partner. So sometimes your partner might be equally lost. So walk over to the fridge and grab a beer, open the beer, and then all of a sudden, just by slowing that down, you can listen to what your friend is saying.
Mm-hmm.
That's another way of slowing stuff down.
Any other pro tips you want to share with us?
Have as much fun as you possibly can on stage. Even if the scene is, even if you're doing the Oresteia or the Diary of Anne Frank, you still should have, like, a lot of fun on stage because that's what we do. We play.
Nick John, thank you so much for being our guest on this episode of Improv Nerd, and we're recording it at the Second City Training Center here in Chicago. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
And there you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I want to thank our guest, Nick John, and I also want to thank Jesse Swanson at the Second City Training Center in Chicago for arranging a space for us to record this episode. I loved Nick when he talked about characters, and I loved his take on using the R word, retarded, on stage. I want to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning classes, workshops, and intensives, go to my website and sign up for my newsletter at jimmycorain.com. Also, like us on Facebook, Improv Nerd. We have a Facebook page because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Also, follow us on Twitter, Improv_Nerd. Go to our YouTube channel, all one word, Improv Nerd Podcast, and sign up for our Patreon subscription where we, each month, we give you a lesson and we give you a full video episode of Improv Nerd. So do that, and that's Patreon/Improv Nerd. Also, I want to thank Feral Audio and being a part of this great, great, growing podcast collective called feralaudio.com. And I'm not forgetting you. I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins. One day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pe in Spanish,
oh my gosh.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my God.